Rav Wine History.
You have one too? No. An MP3 card. I may have to send this to my website.
What's your website?
RabbiWine.com.
Did you have share? Yeah.
Everything.
Really?
More than you need.
You can download right off the internet?
All right, the War of Independence of the State of Israel, which as I mentioned began in 1947, ended in 1949. And the War of Independence has many wars within it. First of all, there were many different Arab armies that did not operate under a joint Arab command in the sense that the armies coordinated their attacks, which certainly helped the Jews repel the armies that came to fight them. There was a great deal of enmity between Egypt and Jordan as to who was going to, it's counting your chickens before the eggs have hatched. There was a lot of enmity and competition within the Arab League regarding the division of the spoils before there were any spoils. But people went into the war with the belief that there's no doubt that there would be spoils, and that therefore much of the Arab military planning was based not only on the resistance of the Jews, but it was based on the fact that, let's say, Egypt had to get to Jerusalem before Jordan got to Jerusalem. And that's not the smartest way to run a war. It's too bad that wars are left to the hands of generals, because there are certain mindsets that defy common sense. So in any event, when the State of Israel was declared, Egyptian bombers bombed Tel Aviv, and the Jordanian Arab Legion was commanded by a British officer, John Glubb. If you wonder, he has an interesting book called Soldier Among the Arabs. and it shows you the war from the other side. The Jordanian Arab Legion was the best disciplined and best armed of all of the Arab armies. And the truth be said, the Israeli army was unable to really cope with it. The Jordanian Arab Legion conquered the old city of Jerusalem, drove the Jews out of the old city. It held on to the pass at Latrun, where the road to Jerusalem was cut, so that no supplies could come from Tel Aviv. Jerusalem was under siege for 9 months. The Arab Legion controlled Gush Etzion, which fell. The Arab Legion was very formidable. And the king of Jordan, then Abdullah, that's this guy Zayda, he was a he was of two minds regarding the Jewish state. He offered that the Jews could remain in the land of Israel under Jordanian citizenship, and that he would protect them and give them all civil and religious rights, but that it would not be a Jewish state. It would be the state of Jordan, which compared to the offers of all the other Arab countries, their offers were to exterminate you, drive you into the sea, at the most send you back to Europe. So this was a pretty magnanimous offer. Ben-Gurion had sent Golda Meir. Ben-Gurion had a special respect for Golda Meir. He would later call her the only man in my cabinet. And Golda Meir went to, disguised, as, went to visit King Abdullah to see if she could come to an accommodation with him. But they could not accept those terms, especially after the fact that the United Nations had passed the partition resolution, and after the fact that Israel was recognized by the Soviet Union and by the United States. It was just too late to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. So the Jordanian Legion was successful, but the Jordanian Legion did not go past the border, so to speak, that Abdullah wanted. He wanted Jerusalem. He wanted Hebron and Gush Etzion, that entire the heartland. And his intention was, and it occurred, that he was going to annex all of this into the Kingdom of Jordan. Had no illusions about the Palestinians. There was not going to be a Palestinian state. To him, all the Arabs were the same. And he was going to therefore annex it and make it part of Jordan. Became part of Jordan. He even considered moving the capital from Amman to Jerusalem. There is a palace that's built outside Jerusalem. It was built by his son, by Hussein, a royal palace, because all the Jordanian monarchs, he and his father, considered it their duty to spend time in the Jerusalem area as well in order to buttress their claim that they are the protectors of the Temple Mount and that Jerusalem really belongs to them. Now the Egyptian army was attacked up the coast.
What was the second mindset?
Pardon?
He has one of two minds.
Now the second mind was that he was going to destroy the Jews. He was going to treat them just the way all the other Arab armies threatened. The Arabs vastly underestimated the Jews. That was part of the problem is that you believe your own propaganda. And part of the propaganda was that the infidels cannot fight those who are the true believers. And also the fact that the Jews were so powerless in World War II influenced the Arabs that they wouldn't be able to mount an effective defense against them. And also the fact that the British were openly on the side of the Arabs, arming them. Many British officers were in the Arab armies. Many British soldiers deserted to the Arab armies. Vast stores of ammunition and guns and material were turned over to the Arab armies by the British. So that the Arabs were vastly overconfident. And therefore, the fact that they were not able to achieve victory hurt even more. Because, like in a sports event, if you're the favorite, and you're the best team, and you lose, it's a much more bitter pill than if you were the underdog and you fought a good game and you played well. So then it's what's known as a moral victory. So you don't get any championships for a moral victory, but at least, you know, you feel good about it. The Arabs never have had a chance to feel good about themselves in the whole 60 years here. And that fuels this bitterness and this almost suicidal behavior. I mean, yes, suicidal behavior, counterproductive behavior. It's a product of the bitterness that it's not supposed to be this way. The Egyptian army came up from the south, came up to the through the Gaza Strip, so it conquered Gaza, and it came up the coast. There were a few kibbutzim along the coast that held up the Egyptian army for a number of weeks. Small kibbutzim. There's a kibbutz Yad Mordechai, Kfar Darom, where literally 150, 200 men held up an army of thousands with tanks. If you visit Yad Mordechai today, they've preserved the battlefield. It's a very interesting visit. Israel is more than just graves if you go to visit, you know. There's a lot to see here. And the fact that the Egyptian army was slowed up allowed the Israelis to concentrate their forces. The Egyptian army was split. They made the mistake also of splitting it into two because they were such a large army, like 15,000 men against 4,000, 5,000 Israelis. So they split it. One took a right turn to go north to Jerusalem, and the other kept on going straight up the coast to go to Tel Aviv. Well, it was obvious that if they would capture Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, it would all be over. And the reason they went to Jerusalem was to prevent Abdullah from taking Jerusalem, which they arrived a little late. The Egyptian army came all the way up to Ramat Rachel, the kibbutz of Ramat Rachel here. It's on the Hebron Road. I don't know, Derech Hebron, if you've ever been towards Talpiot. So today it's a wedding hall, I think, right? Ramat Rachel and the kibbutz has sold off most of its land for apartment buildings that exist in the area. But if you imagine that the Egyptian army is sitting there, right? They're sitting right on that border of Jerusalem. Right here, Highway 1, which runs here, Maladafna. The Jordanian army is sitting here. Or Sameach then as now is no man's land. If you'll notice, all the apartment buildings here are constructed differently, right? And when you go down this Eretz Chefetz Street, etc., they look like fortresses, very small windows, a lot of cement because of the fact there was sniping every day. The Jordanian soldiers had snipers that shot into the buildings. So the buildings were built to prevent the snipers from having clear shots. What is today the museum was the border. That was the last Haganah Jewish outpost right here, again, on Highway 1. And across the street is Mandelbaum Gate. There was a Jew by the name of Mandelbaum. And that's his house, the UN headquarters. The UN flag still flies over it. And that was the crossing point between Jordan and Israel. And Mr. Mandelbaum gained immortality because they made the gate on his property. It was called Mandelbaum Gate. He was a very fine religious Jew who never knew what hit him. But that's a lot of quirks and ironies in human life. So Jerusalem is precarious at best. It's also under siege. How do we break the siege? Well, the Israeli army tried to break it by having convoys come up the road. You can see the burned out, they still have the skeletons of the burned out armored cars along the road here, the Jerusalem Road. Now that they've made it wider and they've made parks on both sides, the armored cars are almost hidden. But there was a time when they were fully visible and much more stark than they are today. They could not break through at Latrun. The Israeli army tried a number of times to break through at Latrun, but the Jordanian legion repulsed them every time. What is today the Israeli Tank Museum at Latrun, you've ever been there? That police fort was the main Jordanian outpost. The Israeli army was successful in capturing the fort, but they couldn't hold on, and they were driven out and driven down again. Across the street today is Mini Israel. You've been there. That was Jordanian territory. And the monastery of Latrun, where the French monks manufacture wine that they ship back to France, wine from the Holy Land. So that was a series of very fierce battles, none of which did the Jews won. The Jews were defeated one day by swarms of flies that prevented them from seeing what they were doing. They were prevented one day by thorns and thistles that were in the line of march, and the infantry got torn up before it could get going. You're talking 60 years ago, is not the sophistication of wars, no cruise missiles, none of that. And therefore, the Jordanians hung on. You had this big bulge between the Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, and there was no way to get materials here. What happened was that an enterprising Israeli soldier discovered an old Roman road that bypassed the Latrun, and through a tremendous dint of effort, great deal of the civilian population of Jerusalem came out every night to help build this road. The road, even when it was built, was not much of a road. It was called the Burma Road, reminiscent of the Burma Road in World War II, where America and England were able to send supplies to China to fight the Japanese. You can go on a tour today of the Burma Road. They cleaned it up a little, but it's still plenty bumpy. But this Burma Road became the road that allowed them to break the siege of Jerusalem, bringing water and arms and men and food and supplies and medicines. People were rationed to a few liters of water a day. That was for everything. Sanitary facilities, washing, eating, drinking, etc. And you're under constant fire all the time, too. You have to realize that the Jews, the Jews that hung out, there's a book by the mayor of Jerusalem then. He was the military commander, and then later became the mayor. His name was Dov Joseph. He was a Canadian Jew. And he wrote a book called The Faithful City, Kiryat Nehemana, from the words of the prophet Isaiah. And he describes, that's a book well worth reading, to give you a sense of what went on. Many of the places that you pass by every day when we never take notice of were the places where great heroism and great sacrifice took place to preserve the Jewish community here in Jerusalem. In the Galil in the north, the Syrian and Lebanese armies attacked, and there was a militia, a Palestinian militia led by a man, Kakauji. So again, it was a question of the Syrians were going to take the Galil. No, the Lebanese wanted the Galil. No, Kakauji, he wanted the Galil. So they never got their act together. And the Israelis, therefore, were able to fight them singly. And they drove all three out of the country. That was the beginning of the flight of the refugees, of the flight of the Arab civilian population. Now, this is all shrouded in mystery. There's no way to reconstruct it. Ben-Gurion claimed, and there are records to that effect, that the Arab armies asked the Arab population to leave the country so that they wouldn't get killed when they destroyed the country and destroyed the Jews, and then they could come back and take everything that they wanted. There are stories, I've heard them from people who were there, that Arabs went through Jewish, for instance, Haifa was a mixed city, had a large Arab population. And Arabs went through and everybody wrote their name on the Jewish man's house, that this was the house they were going to take. But what happened was that the Haganah drove the Arabs out of Haifa. Most of the Arabs fled, though a sizable minority remained, and that's the Arab population there today, and the Arab population in Akko. But the beginning of the exodus of a few hundred thousand Arabs began in the Galilee and then continued throughout the areas that the Jews were able to take over. There's also evidence that the Jews encouraged them to leave, which would also be logical. At the conclusion of the war, Jews made an arrangement with Jordan and with Egypt that they gave up certain pieces in the Negev to the Gaza Strip, etc. And in return, they received what's called the Mishulash, what's called the Galilee, where the bulk of the Arab population in Israel lives today. In other words, Israel absorbed in the trade-off, because of they felt that the territory was more strategic for them, so they absorbed the Arab populations there, which today has grown incrementally to be a very large number of people. Furadis and other Arab cities that exist. The Galil is 50-50 today. Drive of the Jews to settle the Galil has never been successful, because Jews like to live in Tel Aviv and in Jerusalem. Kiryat Sefer, Bnei Brak, you know.
Haifa.
So except for Haifa and the Jewish settlements, most of them are small in number, but the overall there's a very, very large percentage of the population in the Galil that is non-Jewish, that's Arab, Druze, Arab. Now, the United Nations appointed a mediator for peace, and his name was Ralph Bunche, Dr. Ralph Bunche. He was a black American, and he achieved armistice agreements between Israel and Lebanon, Israel and Syria, Israel and Jordan, Israel and Egypt. Iraq was in the war. Iraq also attacked Israel, especially in the area of the Sea of Galilee. But the Iraqis refused to make an armistice with Israel. Until today, legally, there still is a state of war between Iraq and Israel. I don't think the new Iraq is going to be it's much less dangerous to us, but I don't know if it'll be any more friendly to us. Now, Bunche was able to create these armistices, and the lines were drawn. That's what is called today the Green Line, because it was drawn in a green pencil. And the Green Line became the borders of the State of Israel. The armistice agreements projected the idea that within a few months there would be another conference of which a peace treaty would be signed. The hostilities would be ended permanently. That was the view of the matter. It was the view of the United Nations. That was the view of Israel. However, none of the Arab countries were willing to do that. The king of Egypt was driven from his throne because of the defeat of the Egyptian army. And Egypt was taken over by radical colonels. One was Abdul Gamal Nasser, and the other was Mohammed Naguib. Nasser eventually became the dictator. The Jordanian king, Abdullah, was assassinated. He was assassinated here on the Temple Mount. His 18-year-old grandson, King Hussein, was standing next to him. He was leaning on Hussein's arm when he was shot dead. He was shot dead by an Arab fanatic who killed him because of the fact that he suspected that he was going to negotiate with the Jews. The government in Syria from 1948 to 1963, I think they had 23 governments, a little like Italy. Until 1963, the ruling, the Ba'ath party took over. Eventually the Assad family took it over, and they've been the dictators for 40 years. But you had great instability in the Arab world because of the fact that, as I mentioned, you lost, how could you lose? And the people felt, how could they? When you're supposed to win, and you don't win, so then you look for a scapegoat. Why didn't you win? So what happened, first of all, is that the Arab countries expelled all of their Jewish populations. So that 600,000 Sephardic Jews came to the country in the early 1950s, and they came with nothing. The only country that retained somewhat of a Jewish population and still has it today is Morocco. Now, the royal family in Morocco, for various reasons, has been much more protective of its Jews than any of the other Arab countries. So even in the riots that took place, for instance, in Aleppo, in Aram Tzova in Syria, so the great Jewish synagogue was burned down to the ground, and the oldest copy of the Bible, the Keser Aram Tzova, was damaged by raging mobs protesting the proclamation of the State of Israel. They're a little like the cartoon mobs today, you know. Doesn't take much to get them going. And again, when you're poor and disenfranchised and angry and you have no future, you know, so burning down the building gives you satisfaction. You did something today. And especially if it's a building of the other, you know, someone who is different than you. The infidel. So none of the Arab countries came to make peace. And it would not be until 1979, 30 years later, and three wars later, three big wars later, aside from the usual, the regular flies that we have every day. You know my story about the regular flies? It's a good story because you can always use it. When I was the head of kashrus for the OU in America, one of our companies that we supervised was a candy company, big candy company. And, I hate to tell you this, but if you go to a food plant, you know, there are other creatures there as well that are attracted to it. So the federal government inspector found that there were rodent hairs in the warehouse where they stored the boxes for the chocolate. So there was a big article in the New York Times about it, and they were fined $1,000, you know, and they sent in the exterminator. Wonderful. So the Rabbinic Kashrus Commission said to me, how come the Mashgiach didn't see it? Well, you know, it's that was a naive question, let's put it that way. So they said, well, we're going to make a commission, we're going to visit the plant. I said, no, because I'll be happy to guide you through the plant. So they came, and I guided them through the plant. So you go to the food plant, you can't see anything. It's all pipes and noise and drums and, it's just, so we're marching through the plant, and I stay behind a little, and there's a 55-gallon drum of pecans. And so I raise the lid, and there's like a million fruit flies flying around it. So I put the lid down, and I called over to Mashgiach, and I said to him, I picked up the lid. I said, what's going on there? He said, "Rabbi, those are the regular flies." So they're the regular flies and the special flies, right? So this is only the regular flies that we have every day, you know. A rocket here, a rocket there, you know. So stabbing here, that's the regular flies. So it wasn't until 1979 that Egypt signed the treaty, peace treaty. And then in the 1990s, Jordan signed the peace treaty. There was an attempt with Syria also in the 1990s, but Assad backed out at the last moment. So that's the state that we're still in, right? That we're still at, there's no peace treaty with the northern borders.
Sir, yeah. Who's that initiated by the UN, these peace treaties, or is it Israel?
You mean the ones with Egypt and Jordan?
Yeah.
They were bilateral. It was mainly through United States brokerage. Yeah. Jimmy Carter was active in the peace treaty for Egypt, and Clinton was active in the peace treaty with Jordan.
Clinton?
William Jefferson Clinton. Hillary's husband.
The word sin is not in his vocabulary. He said, "I behaved inappropriately." Monica
Lewinsky. That's a different. Sin is, that's a different. We're not dumping. We don't discuss religion here. That's it. Now, in the middle of this, there was a civil war amongst the Jews. There had been three major Jewish armed groups. The largest was the Haganah. The Haganah was under the control of Ben-Gurion. Basically, it was under control of the Labor Party of the left. It was the largest, best equipped, and it became the core of the Israel Defense Forces. Within the Haganah, there was a group called the Palmach. The Palmach was a special like commando group of the most elite soldiers. It was commanded by Yigal Alon.
And Rashi Tevot, Palmach?
Palmach, Pei Lamed Mem Ches, is Plugot Machatz. The shock forces. And so they were an independent entity too. Now Ben-Gurion, correctly so, said we cannot have, 15 militias. Everybody has to become part of the Israel Defense Forces, and everybody has to give in to its authority. Otherwise we will have unending civil war here. So he convinced the Palmach to do so. The Palmach did so peaceably. There was a militia called the Eitzel, the Irgun Tzva Leumi, which was called the Irgun for short, was commanded by Menachem Begin. It was right-wing, revisionist Zionism. There was a lot of bad blood for decades between the revision of Zionists and the general Zionist movement, certainly between Ben-Gurion and Begin. Ben-Gurion was a very strong person, and he was a great hater. And till his dying day, Begin was in the Knesset, and he would never refer to him by name. He would say, "The gentleman who's sitting next to Mr. Goldberg." Would never call him by name.
Did he say gentleman?
Whatever he said.
What's a revisionist?
In the 1920s, Zev Jabotinsky founded an offshoot of the Zionist movement. He called it revisionist Zionism. And the other one was political Zionism, which was led by Weizmann. And Jabotinsky's contention was that no Jewish state would arise unless the Jews fought for it, and that to rely on the British or anybody else to make it for you was just foolishness. and therefore he advocated armed revolt. His economics was much more capitalistic than the left, and the revisionists were a powerful force, but they never were the majority.
So just within the Labour and the right wing, was it a similar split of types of Jews, Eastern European Jews?
Yes. The split began there. We have imported all the fights here. There's no Tzeret Haaretz here. All the religious fights, everything, we've imported it all from the exile. We brought it all with us in the suitcases. Can't let go of it. In fact, these fights are minor compared to what went on in Eastern Europe. The example that I always use is that in Eastern Europe, the Bund, which was the Jewish labor union, the socialist labor union, held its annual banquet on Kol Nidre night. In Vilna, you know, a block and a half from the synagogue of the Gaon of Vilna. See, nobody in Israel would do that today. So the religious are not so religious, and the secular are not so secular anymore. It's not the way it was. In any event, the Irgun fought its own wars against the Arabs, especially against the British, driving them out of the country, forcing them to give up the mandate, and against the Haganah too. There was a ship called the Altalena, which the Irgun had purchased, and they bought arms in Czechoslovakia. This is also one of the twists. The Jews really didn't have strong armaments, major armaments, and Britain wouldn't sell them, and the United States had an embargo against selling to anybody in the Middle East, which in effect meant against selling to Israel. There were American Jews that went to jail for smuggling arms to Israel. Hank Greenspan, who was the editor of the Las Vegas Sun.
My cousin, Cy Warsaw.
They went to jail. 4 years in jail because they took apart a B-17 bomber, put it in the crates, marked down that it was textile goods, and it ended up bombing Cairo. And there were many American Jews that risked a lot to try and circumvent that embargo.
Czechoslovakia
also. So what happened was that by an absolute quirk of whatever we call it, fate is too mild a word. Soviet Union, Stalin, who usually was a very shrewd judge of matters, the Soviet Union became convinced that the Israeli Communist Party would be able to make a coup in Israel and deliver the state of Israel into the Soviet bloc, which meant that the Soviet Union would have this great, strong foothold in the Middle East, which it always coveted. Because of that, his conviction, the Soviet Union voted in favor of the partition resolution in the United Nations. And the Soviet Union also, right after Truman recognized the State of Israel, the Soviet Union recognized the State of Israel. Now, the Soviet Union became the greatest enemy of the State of Israel and the Jewish people in the second half of the 20th century. Only now are we discovering the lengths that it went to try and destroy the State of Israel. Absolutely destroy it. But at this time, Stalin was convinced that the Jewish communists were going to do it for him here. In so doing, he didn't reckon with Ben-Gurion. Now, Ben-Gurion was a leftist and a socialist, but he was not a communist. And he smelled out right away what the problem would be. And he determined that the state of Israel would go with the West in the Cold War and not with the East. And he crushed the Communist Party, so that it had very small representation and certainly never had a chance to stage the coup that Stalin thought it would. But in the beginning, Stalin has still got this idea. And since nobody would sell arms to the state of Israel, so Russia, in its piety, couldn't sell arms either. But Russia controlled Czechoslovakia, which was then the satellite of Russia. And in the Czech government, there were many Jews. In fact, in all of the communist governments, there were many Jews. But in the Czech government especially had many Jews. Ben-Gurion sent a young child by the name of Shimon Peres to Prague, who negotiated the deal. Peres is one of the great enigmas in the story of the Jewish people, because he's done so much good for us. He's the one who got France to build us a nuclear reactor. He's the one who broke the back of the inflation in the 1980s. He got us out of the mess of the Lebanese War. Complicated.
And didn't draft army yeshiva students.
Yeah, that's right. He's very complicated, like all of you, you know. So the Czechoslovakia had a very large armament industry called the Skoda Works. Today they didn't make cars. Half the taxis in Israel are Skodas. They use the same upholstery that they do for the tanks. And Czechoslovakia sold Israel heavy weapons, mortars, artillery, heavy machine guns, weapons that put the Israeli army on a par with the equipment of the Arab armies. There were Jews, both American and Israeli, that scoured Europe. Now, in Europe, after the Second World War, there were weapons all over the place. And for money, money's a wonderful thing. You can do a lot of things with it. For instance, Israeli Air Force had Messerschmitt fighters. You had German Panzer tanks. You had French tanks. You had English tanks. Whatever was lying around. Whatever could be picked up. So the Irgun also picked up weapons. And they loaded them on this ship called the Altalena. And the Altalena steams into Tel Aviv harbor. Ben-Gurion finds out about it. And he orders the ship to be anchored, and everybody should leave the ship. And that all the arms be turned over to the IDF, to the Israel Defense Forces. The Irgun refuses. When the Irgun refuses, Ben-Gurion orders the Israel Army to shoot at the Altalena. The commander of the force that shot at the Altalena was a young soldier by the name of Yitzhak Rabin. Let's make the story even more interesting. On the Altalena, there was an Irgun captain by the name of Avraham Stavsky. Now, in the late 1920s, there was a labor leader of the labor faction in the General Zionist Movement, by the name of Arlazarov. There's a street named for Arlazarov in every city in Israel. Arlazarov was assassinated. He was walking with him down the boardwalk in Tel Aviv on a Friday night, and two people walked over to him and shot him dead. Never found out who the two people were. However, the British investigated. The Zionists howled. The British investigated, and they arrested Stavsky as being the assassin. Stavsky said he didn't do it, and he said it was a witch hunt against the revisionists. It was a terrible time. Rav Kook, who was then the chief rabbi here, defended Stavsky, and that cost him a great deal of support that previously he had had in the General Zionist Movement. But he said that Stavsky was innocent. The British tried Stavsky. Originally, they found him guilty and sentenced him to death. But on a retrial, he was acquitted. Stavsky's on the boat on the Alta Lena, and he's killed there.
By someone on the Alta Lena?
No. He's killed by the fire of the Israel Defense Forces on shooting at the ship. The ship is beached, it's sunk, it explodes. There were numerous people killed. So here is open civil war. And to Begin's everlasting credit, Begin said, "We will not fight a civil war. Everybody from the Irgun should be incorporated into the Israel Defense Forces. We disband the Irgun," which he did. Now, for long periods of time, the people who had been with the Irgun rarely found advancement in the Israel Defense Forces. There's this underlying tension which existed here for decades and decades. And it still exists to a certain extent. Yes.
Didn't Begin surrender and also offer the arms before Rabin shot?
Yeah. So then there's, you know, now it depends which side of the story you hear.
Confirmed.
If you go to the Begin Museum or the Jabotinsky Museum in Tel Aviv, the Begin Museum here in Jerusalem, which is a very interesting place. If you have a chance, you should all go.
What is it?
It's an abattoir. It's you know where the train station is, where the road curves. You just go straight. Instead of going Derech Hebron, just go straight a little, and it's right there. It's in back of the Jerusalem, the Cinematheque Theater. So if you go to the Begin Museum, you get one set of stories. If you go to the Palmach Museum in Tel Aviv, you get the other side of the story. So you have the choice. And it's interesting, they both have film and they both have documents to prove it. So that's... But what is true is that the boat could have marked the beginning of a terrible civil war. And the civil war never happened. In 1949, Ben-Gurion calls for elections for the first Israeli Knesset. The first Israeli Knesset building is here in Jerusalem on King George Street. That I think it's the Ministry of Tourism or something today, or I think the Rabbanut, it's the Bet Din of the Rabbanut today. Pardon? No.
The tourist office.
Tourist office, yeah, that's it. It's down, it's closer to Yaffa.
Next to Trefa Butcher.
So, the Knesset is going to have 120 seats because it's based on the idea of the Anshei Knesset Agdola, at the beginning of the Second Commonwealth, which had 120 members. Aside from the name, there is little resemblance between the two. There's no constitution in the state of Israel. So everything is done by the seat of its pants, because, you know, everything, they make it up as they go along. Israel institutes a greatly democratic system of proportional representation of the political parties, meaning that if you get 14% of the vote, of the overall vote in the country, you get 14% of the 120 seats. It sounds like a great democratic thing, but what it does is it allows for a vast number of parties to participate. So they keep on raising the minimum level. I think it's up to 3%, that in order to get any seat, you have to have at least 3% of the vote today. But then, and there were a lot of parties, and nobody knew who was going to win the election. And you had the 100,000 Jews from Cyprus, Eastern European Jews from Cyprus, that were brought into the land of Israel. If you go to the Israeli military cemeteries, you'll notice that there are many graves of people who came to Israel July 11th, 1948, and fell in battle July 13th, 1948. Because the situation was of such a nature that they took those that they felt were able-bodied and young enough, they took them off the boat and gave them a gun and said, go shoot. And no one can judge these things. So you're going to have this election. Now the election so terrified the religious parties that they formed one party. First and last time in the history of the state of Israel. So the religious Zionists, the Aguda, everybody ran together. The Pole Aguda, the Pole Mizrahi, everybody ran together. And because of that, they were quite successful. And because they were quite successful, the Labor Party, which won the largest number of seats, but never won, no party has ever won a majority of seats here. So every government has to be a coalition government. So the religious parties became the partners to the coalition. And the religious parties were the partner to the coalition government for most of the first 40, 45 years of the state. Because of that, therefore, the question of religion, the state of Israel, always remained a political question. Not a social question, or not even a religious question. And because of that, the issue is an extremely divisive one. Because we're talking about budgets, money, patronage, power. We're not talking about the Shulchan Aruch. We are now witness to the fact that, for instance, the religious Zionist party is practically out of business. United Torah Judaism has got four factions in its unity. The Sfardim have split off, and they've got Shas. So, on one hand, it's a sign of strength, because each one thinks it's strong enough to go on its own. Which in 1948, or 49, none of them felt they were strong enough to go on their own. Out of desperation, they had to unite. But it's also a sign of weakness because of the fact that if you're so fragmented and you're really working against yourselves, then it's very difficult to have that kind of influence on the society. Okay, so we'll talk next time, God willing. Stay well, stay warm. Have a good job.
Life is traumatized and depressed to this day.
That's right. It was a rough time.